In May 1980, workers and students in Gwangju, South Korea, rose up against the brutal US-backed dictatorship. They drove out murderous special forces troops and ran Gwangju collectively for several days until eventually government forces retook the city. This is Working Class History. Hi, and welcome back to the Working Class History Podcast. Firstly, just a quick reminder that this podcast is only made possible because of support from you, our listeners, on Patreon. We've been working on these episodes for a bit over a year, and in addition to the dozens of hours of research, writing, recording and so on, we've also had to pay for translation, transcription, editing and the like. So we're extremely grateful for generous support from our listeners, which makes this possible. If you can, please consider supporting our work, where you also get exclusive benefits like early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and more. For example, you can listen to the whole of this mini-series now, as well as a bonus episode. Learn more and sign up at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. Link in the show notes. In this episode, we're beginning a mini-series on the Gwangju Uprising of 1980, sometimes known as the 518 Uprising, due to it beginning on May the 18th. Although unsuccessful in achieving its goals at the time, it was a landmark event in the restoration of democracy and the establishment of workers' rights in South Korea. And it's a really inspiring story of courageous resistance and self-management of an entire city in the face of absolutely horrific state violence. It's also a story which is very little known and hardly mentioned in mainstream media or educational establishments, especially relative to its importance. Particularly when you look at comparable events like the Tiananmen Square protests in China. Personally, I've been wanting to make a podcast about the Gwangju Uprising for some time, especially after visiting the city a couple of years ago, going to some of the sites where key events in the rebellion took place, some of which look pretty much the same as they did in photos from 1980, like the fountain around which thousands of people would gather to rally and make decisions, and the provincial office which became the headquarters of the rebels and the location of their heroic last stand against the paratroopers. But as I said, it wasn't an easy undertaking due both to language barriers and finding people who took part in it to speak to. So we are really indebted to a number of people who've helped us put these episodes together, who we'll mention as we go through the episodes, as well as our Patreon supporters, without whom we just wouldn't have been able to do this. A short content note to begin with. This episode contains brief descriptions, but of graphic violence and sexual violence. As usual, we're going to start off with a bit of background. We're not going to go into this in that much detail because we basically did that in our episode 51 about South Korean labor organizers Chun Tae-il and Lee So-sun. But essentially, Korea was annexed by Japan in 1910, and after Japan's defeat in World War II, the southern portion of the country was occupied by the US, and a series of military dictatorships were then set up, with backing and support from the US, which governed the region for most of the next few decades up to the 1980s. Particularly from the 1960s, they were focused on economic development, based on the super-exploitation of manufacturing workers, particularly women and girls working in the textile and garment industry earlier on, and later more male workers in heavy industry. Hours were long, pay was low, and conditions were dangerous. There were no independent unions, no real workers' rights, and any organization of workers was heavily repressed by state security forces, including the police and intelligence services, the KCIA.
To understand that issue, we have to talk about the person called Park Chung-hee, who ruled Korea since 1961 through 1979, when he was assassinated by his right-hand man, Kim Jae-gyu. Park was a former army officer of Manchukuo, the purpose state of Japanese imperialism in the 1930s.
This is Kap Soo-sol. Kap is a researcher and writer who was a high school student in Seoul at the time of the uprising. He also translated the seminal book Gwangju Diary, Beyond Death, Beyond the Darkness of the Age.
We don't know much about Manchukuo. They never teach at school about the Manchukuo, but Manchukuo was where Park was trained, and Park was got his first vision about what country he should build in South Korea. And in the 70s, South Korea is more like Manchukuo, where there's no democratic process. It was completely ruled by bureaucracy and the military. All resources, human, economic, were mobilized to build a strong state with a strong military, what they call Buguganguk. So there's no individual political freedom whatsoever. And the labor union were smashed. Many political dissidents was in prison, but all breakdown on October 26th, he was murdered by his right-hand man, Kim Jae-gyu. Prior to his assassination, there was, for the first time in his role, there was a mass strike and a mass protest, led a mass protest in two major cities, Masan and Busan, in southern eastern area, where he come from, and where his main supporter are living and making their samples rich. It was a big shock to Park Jong-hee.
Through the 1970s, there was a wave of self-organization and struggles by textile and garment workers, which we spoke about in episode 51. This culminated in some major struggles in 1979 by women workers in places like the YH Wig Factory, and then urban uprisings in Masan and Busan. Then all of a sudden, Park Chung-hee got assassinated one night at dinner by Kim Jae-gyu, his personal security chief and head of the KCIA. Even today, no one is quite sure exactly why this happened. It could have been, as Kim later claimed, to try to restore democracy, or it could have been due to political or personal rivalries or some other reason. In any case, in the chaos that ensued, a military general named Chun Doo-hwan seized power in December 1979. A contributing factor to this upsurge in struggle was collective efforts to educate working class people by church groups and others. One member of such a group was Jun Yong-ho, a Chonam University student, who Michael Choi kindly interviewed for us when he attended the 40th anniversary commemorations of the uprising in Gwangju last year. Jun is a man, and his words were dubbed and translated by Angela Lee.
I was born in 1957 in Cheongnam, Chungcheon. My childhood and elementary school years was in Osun, and then I moved to Cheongju, where I've lived until now. I was a student in Cheongnam University, and I volunteered as a teacher with this group, Tulpur Yahak, or the Wildfire Night School. In 1978 in Gwangju, the Wildfire School was created as part of a workers' awakening. Mr. Ki-sun Park, Mr. Kim Young-chul, and a few others were involved in the formation. It was in the mid-70s. The intent was to create a space for workers to realize their consciousness and discover their rights, to grow and educate themselves.
Going back a bit again, Park Chung-hee initially took power in a military coup in 1961, which was subsequently ratified by elections, although the political environment of South Korea at the time was hardly conducive to free and fair elections, and he was very much focused on economic growth.
At the time, in the 70s, many cheap industrial products were being produced and exported. There were a lot of factories being built, and people from rural areas flocked to the cities to work as low-wage factory workers.
Actually, what we should note is that economic growth under Park Chung-hee was very rare. Actually, he lifted so many people from poverty, but many more left behind. Typically, in Honam area, where Gwangju is located, there was a strong regional bias against Gwangju and Honam, and the entire area were left out, and that there was no big factory in this area, although regime began make a huge investment in southeast area where their leader come from. So there is a big disparity and inequality in South Korea. And basically, people are very unhappy with Park Chung-hee as he grow his regime getting grow older. So that's what happened.
To explain the geography a bit, Honam is the southwesterly portion of South Korea, which used to be the historical Chola province, which contains the modern-day provinces of North Chola, South Chola, and the city of Gwangju, which was then the provincial capital of South Chola. So the terms Chola and Honam are pretty much used interchangeably in these episodes.
So that region is referred to as Cholanando, or the province of South Chola. It was actually sort of forgotten about by the Korean government. We didn't really have the highest standard of living.
This is David Doninger. He was a Peace Corps volunteer from the US, working at a health center in tuberculosis control, about 30 miles outside of Gwangju.
As I tell people about living back then, there were no paved roads in the town and in the county where I lived. Everything was dirt roads. We had one road that just came to the edge of town, and that was what the bus drove on. Other than that, it was all dirt. We still had homes at that point in time that had thatched roofs. So we were not that well off. We were mainly in a farming area, the farming community. But because of the politics of Korea at that time, Cholonam-do especially was forgotten by the government. And that was because Park Chung-hee had come from a rival province, which was on the east coast of Korea.
Park's regional bias was deeply political. In elections in 1971, 95% of the vote in Gwangju went to Kim Dae-jung, probably South Korea's most famous pro-democracy opposition figure. Park won the general election overall in very suspicious circumstances, and soon afterwards he granted himself even more dictatorial powers, which were then codified in the Yushin Constitution enacted in 1972.
Park wanted to sideline Gwangju and the Hunan area because that's where his arch rival Kim Dae-jung came from. And Kim Dae-jung almost defeat Park Chung-hee some years back in 1971. And basically the election was leaked. So Park somehow managed to steal the presidential election. After that, he basically institutionalized some kind of racism against, regional bias against Hunan people. And typically Samsung, one of the largest companies in South Korea, does not hire college graduate from Gwangju or Hunan. And there are two major factories in Gwangju area. One is Asia Motors. The other is Ilsan Bangjik, Ilsan Garment Factory. They are orbit during the Japanese colonial times. That there's no major plant newly built in Gwangju and Jeonnam area in the past 40 years, especially during the Park Chung-hee's rule. So people, average worker in Gwangju, took home half the wage other workers earn in other cities, such as Seoul or Busan. That there are many, many people who we now call precarious worker who have to make a living on a daily basis. They work in the small factory, restaurant, and just whatever they can do, they provide their service, whatever they can do. It was an extremely poor city. At the same time, Gwangju was the logistic hub of the region in the education center of the province. So there are many young students in the city. There are more high school students than junior high school students in the city. And there are about 20 colleges in the city of 730,000 people. So Gwangju was packed with the young people who are very discontent and they discourage you with the Park's regime because Park's regime does not offer any real future for them.
Across South Korea as a whole, there were not a very large number of students. But in Gwangju, they made up a substantial proportion of the population, around 25% of the total.
So there weren't too many people going to universities, only about 20 to 30%. Young people were so poor at the time. It wasn't even about what your career and salary was. It was worrying about what to eat.
So this was the general background in Honam province when Chun Doo-hwan seized power.
Chun Doo-hwan, I think there's a major difference between Chun Doo-hwan's generation and the Park's generation. Chun Doo-hwan is educated in U.S. He was trained in Fort Benning, where many American ally soldiers were trained. He was one of the first South Korean general who got trained in special warfare and psychological warfare. And his older generation, Park's generation, all educated in Japan, and that they fought in Korean War, and the Chun Doo-hwan fought in Vietnam War. that there's a slight difference. Jeon is more like, he know how things work better than Park Jeong-hee in terms of politics. He tried to employ a combination of appeasement of repression during his rule. But that said, John Doan has a two stage of a coup. First one happened in December 97. He shot his way to power by rounding a senior general and killing some. And it was not just a coup, but it was also, as I told you, it was a generation shift in the military. So now new generation who fought in Vietnam, who educated in U.S., hold the power in the military. Then 6 months later, in May 18, he staged another coup by lifting martial law to the maximum level. So practically every single part of Korea, including Jeju Island, under martial law, and he disbanded National Assembly and shut down the administration body of the government.
On the 13th of May, large street demonstrations began in Seoul calling for an end to martial law. These spread to Gwangju the following day, when students from Chonam and Chosun universities took to the streets and battled with riot police. On the 15th of May, the protests in Gwangju grew, with students being joined by other local people, also demanding workers' rights and democratic reforms. At the end of the day on the 15th, protests in Seoul and other cities were called off by organizers.
On May 14th, 15th, 16th, for 3 days, we all gathered at the Munju University Plaza to demonstrate and to demand for a quicker transition to democracy. That was the beginning of the demonstrations. University students would gather at their respective schools to demand democracy or stand up against abusive acts squashing democracy.
Gwangju was the only city where there was a demonstration on May 16. A day before May 15, students in other regions decided to stop them protesting. And basically, they want to see what happened. That's because they could not win any popular support over the weeks of protests before. But Gwangju was different. Many citizens joined the student protest, and even college professor joined the student protest on May 16.
On Friday the 16th, I actually went to Gwangju because I was on the way to a friend's wedding that was going to occur on Saturday. And so I spent the night in Gwangju because of having worked all day and the bus system at that point in time. And actually, I have had a lot of friends that were actually college students. And I had met one young lady who I knew on the bus going to Gwangju. And she and I went to see her brother. And at that point in time, I was actually told about the candlelight march that they were going to have on Friday. So I actually took part in the candlelight march, not actually in the street, but on the sidewalk. So I visualized that as that went from the train station to the provincial office building. The next morning, I actually took off for the wedding because I didn't really want to miss that. And actually having talked to the students, that was the last protest they were going to have. They had been asked by the government to stop protesting, to go back to the campuses, and allow democracy to occur. So they had acquiesced and said, okay, we'll do that. But they had this one last candlelight march. And the next day, they went back to the universities.
On the 17th of May, the government said that the National Assembly was going to meet to discuss lifting martial law and bringing in reforms. So activists were heartened by this. But then, from that afternoon, the government instead started rounding up dissidents en masse. In Seoul, most known democracy activists were rounded up. And at 11 p.m. in Gwangju, police and intelligence agents raided the homes and arrested almost every known dissident, other than those who managed to evade officers and go into hiding. Kim Dae-jung was one of those arrested. Shortly before midnight on the 18th of May, the government declared a state of emergency and announced that martial law would be extended to cover the whole country. Here, Jun says midnight on the 17th of May, but that basically refers to 0-100 hours on the 18th of May.
That's when the soldiers were deployed at each of the universities, At midnight on May 17th, every university outside Seoul were crawling and eventually just overrun with soldiers. This all happened overnight, so the Chungnam University students didn't know of the military presence. All they knew was of the plan to meet again to demonstrate.
Back in Seoul, Cap experienced the crackdown as well.
I was rocking up go to elementary school, which was a part of a college campus. One day, when I went to school on May 18, my elementary school was occupied by paratroopers because of martial law. And as a kid, every Korean kid learned to respect a soldier and love them. And I say hello to them, the soldiers, and they were very nasty. And with even children, they swear at us, they push away us. And they even occupy our playground. We didn't have any physical training class over the 3 months. So that was when I first questioned what these soldiers are, why they are here for. My teacher could not explain anything because they fear for the worst thing that might happen if they explain anything about this. And I still vividly remember in late May, the paratrooper left the campus and he was replaced by an average infantry unit. They are more kindly, more like a brotherly uncle kind of figure. They are very kind to us. I even play soccer with them. The paratrooper was very nasty and they swear at us. I saw one paratrooper swearing at my teachers too. So, as a kid, it was the first time to question what is soldier? Why are so aggressive with us? We are just a kid. That why they did not let me play in my playground. That question mostly answered by the time when I went to high school. I began to read the book, The Gwangju Diary, which was semi-legal back then. I somehow got a copy. So the question finally answered why the soldier was so nasty with me and what they did in Gwangju.
On the morning of the 18th of May in Gwangju, riot police and paratroopers were everywhere. As a bit of background, to this day, the US maintains effective control of the South Korean military, although the paratroopers, elite special forces soldiers, were under the direct control of Chungju-1. We're going to talk more about US involvement in the events later. As well as security forces, Gwangju residents and students also began to take to the streets in protests at the escalating repression.
Chosun students gathered at Chosun and other university students at their respective schools. At around 9 a.m., the students began to gather at the entrance of Chungnam University, but the soldiers were there now, preventing entry. By 10 a.m., there were about 200 students gathered at the entrance. That's when the conflict began. But the students just have their bare hands and the soldiers are armed with guns. So the students are being chased out and pushed around. So Chungnam University and the student conflict there was the starting point. I arrived a bit late there and came by the city bus. The bus route was supposed to pass South Chunla around 11 a.m. and then to Chungnam University. I was supposed to be at Chungnam University by 10 a.m., so I was late, you see. And on the way there, I saw about 100 students running in a panic. So those were the students that were at Chungnam University at 10 a.m. That's when I got off the bus and joined the demonstration. And we protested until the 27th.
Clashes spread through the city. In some places, riot police used tear gas to try to disperse demonstrators. Elsewhere, paratroopers rushed in, grabbed individual demonstrators and savagely beat them. As the violence of the security forces escalated, so did the resistance. Protesters began picking up rocks and pieces of wood to fight the soldiers and making petrol bombs. One group raided a police substation and demolished it, and threw stones at the most luxurious mansion in the city.
The Air Force soldiers would come and harass civilians. They would stop and capture people on the street and beat them. They'd make people kneel on the street and take their clothes off, and that's why we were demonstrating.
By late afternoon, police and soldiers started beating people to death. Paratroopers picked up the bloodied bodies and threw them into trucks in piles. Many of them had previously been involved in suppressing rebellions in Masan and Busan the previous year. Soon, soldiers started using bayonets to stab people. At the bus terminal, they stopped all the buses, dragged off young people and beat them, as well as just some drivers and women ticket takers. Elder people who saw what was going on just cried in the streets. One middle-aged bystander who saw kids beaten to death said that he'd fought in the Vietnam War and killed Viet Cong, but even the notoriously brutal South Korean troops in Vietnam hadn't been this cruel. Even he reportedly shouted to bystanders, quote, "We should kill all these bastards," referring to the paratroopers. By the early evening, school and university students armed themselves with whatever they could find, steel pipes, kitchen knives, and in some areas they even forced paratroopers to retreat, until nightfall when the students returned to their homes, while the army declared a curfew and roamed the streets, arresting anyone who even looked like a student. Meanwhile, underground groups hastily organized themselves and began printing leaflets and newsletters about what happened and handing them out on the streets, while factory workers gathered to discuss what was going on.
So this is all happening in the midst of the cities, but people in the suburbs had no way to see what was going on. So we had to inform the suburbians about what was going on, and we wanted them to join us.
The government then imposed total martial law and said that the unrest had to stop. But the following morning, the 19th of May, Gwangju residents again took to the streets in defiance of the military, who were all over the city. Universities and colleges were shut down, but schools, factories and other workplaces remained open. But that day, more and more non-students began taking to the streets as well, particularly housewives and street vendors. And the paratroopers continued to become even more brutal. Anyone resisting arrest was bayoneted. Women in particular were stripped naked in the streets and kicked unconscious. A group of 50 school children who'd witnessed an assault had their school raided, and they were all beaten unconscious and thrown on a truck. Even police officers attempting to assist wounded people were beaten by soldiers. This violence brought even more people onto the streets, and by the afternoon of the 19th, local residents began to outnumber students, and their militancy increased. Women broke up cobblestones to be thrown at the soldiers, while numerous people started hijacking vehicles and oil drums, setting them alight and driving them at police barricades. One group of demonstrators armed with steel pipes managed to capture a group of paratroopers and seize their weapons. But this small victory was short-lived, as more paratroopers soon arrived, beat the demonstrators to death, and threw their bodies off the roof of the building.
One oversized sector in the city was the transport, because it's logistic hub. There are many independent taxi driver, what New Yorkers say, gypsy cabs in Gwangju, and that there are many freelance truckers. That these drivers were the first-hand eyewitness of the carnage by military. Military smashed their car when they driver tried to dodge the injured protester to safety.
In addition to their cars being destroyed, numerous taxi drivers carrying the wounded were pulled from their vehicles and stabbed to death with bayonets. Local hospitals and health centers were overwhelmed with the wounded and dying. The army called in 18,000 extra police for reinforcements. But on the other side, the numbers were growing too. Students at Chungang Girls' School and other high schools walked out of class, while construction workers and middle-aged people joined in the fighting. Demonstrators attacked the Korean Broadcasting System building, burned down a police substation, and managed to win a small number of tactical victories in the streets.
And during the demonstrations on the 19th of May, one Air Force soldier was left behind. All of the people were out on the streets, and this one soldier was isolated in a sea of people. The civilians began throwing rocks and overpowered the soldiers, and he retreated, limping.
At nightfall, the exhausted rebels who had escaped injury or death returned home and put on the news to see the events that day completely ignored. Meanwhile, the government called in more troops. The following day, the insurrection would dramatically escalate, and while many more would be killed by paratroopers, By the end of the 21st of May, the workers and residents of Gwangju had succeeded in liberating the city and driving out the police and the army. The story continues in part two of this mini-series. Our Patreon supporters can listen to that and all other parts of this mini-series now. You can also get other great exclusive benefits. So learn more about this and sign up at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. For everyone else, future parts will be out each week. As always, we've got more information, sources, photos, and transcripts on the webpage for this episode. Link in the show notes. We'd like to thank all of our guests for speaking with us, as well as to Michael Choi for undertaking interviews in Gwangju, and Angela Lee, Jiminy Lee, and the Hung Coalition, who helped with translation and dubbing. Huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who make this podcast possible. Special thanks to Connor Kanatsi, Shay, James, and Ariel Joya. If you can't spare the cash to support us right now, no worries. Please just tell your friends and family about us, or give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app. Theme music for this episode was Marching for the Beloved, a song about the Gwangju Uprising, by Baek Ki Won, Wang Suk Young, and Kim Jong Ryul. Link to stream it in the show notes. Thanks to Jesse French for editing this episode. And finally, thanks to you for listening. Catch you next time.